From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Judith Flanders says pretty much everything you know about Christmas is wrong. She isn't being snarky or smug or superior when she says it. She's making a larger point that when it comes to Christmas, the things that are actually true about the holiday are hard to separate from the things we want to be true. Like the idea that Christmas used to be a pure religious celebration, for example. That's not true. Or that Santa Claus was created in the Netherlands. Not true. Or that it's only been in modern times that materialism or greed has ruined the meaning of Christmas. Not true. Flanders is joining us today to bust a few myths about Christmas. She calls her book about the holiday a biography. Join us after the news.
There were some surprises in 2017.
People flocked to Idaho and Wyoming to view the total solar eclipse.
Oh, yeah!
That's Venus.
He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl!
The owners took down their glass sign curtain, brought it outside, and smashed it.
BYU students woke up to a tweet from their school that simply said, "It's happening." There was a picture of a can of Coke.
Please hurry. The year is almost over, and we still need your support. Make your gift today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Every Christian has a perfect Christmas memory in mind. For a lot of us, it's when we were kids, and waking up was unbelievably exciting. The image is gauzy and warm. Maybe there was a fire and a tree, of course. Truth is, the one memory was probably a bunch that we stitched together, and there's a chance it didn't really happen, or not in the way we remember. You know how memories are. The historian Judith Flanders says each of us is a storehouse of Christmases, a repository of all the happiness and sometimes sadness of seasons past. And because of that, because we think Christmas is magical, we believe impossible things about it. Flanders has written a book about Christmas. She calls it a biography. And in it, she tries to separate what is actually true about the holiday from what we think is true or hope is true. Flanders is an historian of the Victorian era. She's written a number of books about it. Her new book is called Christmas, a Biography. She joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. And at first, she says, writing a history of Christmas seemed pretty straightforward. But it didn't take long for her to realize most of what we know about Christmas is wrong.
Well, I think everybody thinks it's simple. You know, you have the nice church history at the beginning, and then you have this sort of warm family element in the middle, and then it all degenerates and everything disintegrates and the modern world is just awful and Christmas isn't what it used to be.
Yeah.
And it didn't take much more than a few weeks of research before I realized this is just not the way the story happened. One of the main elements of Christmas has always been that it used to be better.
Yeah.
The earliest reference I could find was 1616 in a play by Ben Jonson, where a character says, basically, I'm paraphrasing, of course, "Oh, modern Christmas is terrible. Yeah. You should have seen it in the good old days."
Right.
So the other element is that the church beginnings were not what I expected.
Yeah.
There is, as I think is well known, no mention of Christmas itself in the Bible.
Yeah.
There is the story of the Nativity, which is only in two of the Gospels, both of which were written about a century after the supposed birth of Christ. Christmas itself was first named as a feast of the Christian church in the 4th century. And within 30 years of that day being set aside for the celebration of the Nativity, you have the church leadership, you have the Archbishop of Constantinople warning his congregation about feasting to excess and dancing on the day.
Right.
In the 7th century, again, the Archbishop of Canterbury reminds his followers that it's all right to have a holiday meal, but the church frowns on gluttony on the day. Well, all parents know you don't warn people about things they don't do.
Right.
You don't say to kids, don't put beans up your nose, because kids don't put beans up their nose.
Yeah.
So in a similar way, historians often look for what people are being told not to do, because it tells us what they were doing.
Right.
And so 30 years after the first Christmas was marked by the Christian church, they are feasting to excess and they are dancing.
I want to dig into this as we go. I want to back up, though, and talk about this something you mentioned early on, this I guess the Christmas of our memories, because it seems like it's a theme in the book in some ways, this idea that the Christmas we have in our mind was flawless, you know, seared into our memories. It's the day we can't really recapture. And I wanted to have you talk a little bit about that, because as you write in the book, it's this time of the year that what is true and what we think is true about Christmas is hard to separate from what we would simply like to believe is true. Say something about that.
I think that that is very much the case, but I think what we don't know, it's important that we don't know for our own sense of what the day is, that nostalgia is the core of the day.
Yeah.
So whether we are thinking about this, as you say, this perfect Christmas of our own past, our own childhood, or whether it's the perfect Christmas that our parents or our grandparents have told us about, or it's the perfect Christmas of a time past, we look back, say, to Norman Rockwell in the 1950s. Norman Rockwell, in turn, looked back to the 19th century. In the 19th century, they looked back to the Tudor period, to the 16th century. There has always been a looking back, because what Christmas really is it's a belief that times can be better. And to believe that times can be better, we have to believe that times once were better.
Yeah. So you mentioned these common assumptions that we have that aren't quite right. You mentioned the religious part, and we'll talk about that and get back to that in a moment. This idea that we've always seen Christmas as being debased. But there's the second assumption, you say, that we hold, that we believe our traditions, the one from our own, you know, whatever, countries, whatever that might be, are the only real ones, the only ones that are legit.
We have two kinds of our traditions.
Yeah.
We have the traditions of our own culture, and we have the traditions of our own home.
Yeah.
So each family has its own rituals. Do you do presents on Christmas Eve, or do you do them on Christmas morning? Do you do them before church or after church? When do you have your big meal? All of those are family traditions that somehow, if they get broken, we're doing it wrong. But equally, each culture has its own traditions. And this is fascinating to a historian, because while we do all have our own traditions, if you look at the history of Christmas, you see how these traditions have shifted and moved across cultures and borders. They don't believe that they are. Things like having turkey for Christmas. Turkey only arrived in Europe in the 16th century, brought from the New World by the Spanish. So until the 16th century, turkey was simply an impossibility, because it didn't exist in Europe.
Yeah.
And yet somehow by the 18th, 19th century, this is a very standard Christmas meal. Christmas trees.
Yeah.
We all know that they are German in origin. And yet we believe the way we do, whoever the we is. Do you decorate, you know, when do you put them up? When do you take them down? What do you decorate them with? Is absolutely a cultural thing of each place. Do you put it in the window? Do you put it on the porch? All of these elements are community by community, country by country. And yet we assimilate them all.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you go to places which don't even have any major Christian element. Japan, say. I mean, Christmas trees outdoors or in commercial premises are an enormous thing.
It's an amalgam of traditions, isn't it? I mean, that seems like that's what the traditions we think are set in stone have never really been that, not really. And the traditions that we have are all over the place. And that's always been the case, I guess.
Well, the fascinating thing is that the traditions that we think are set in stone are, as you say, totally amorphous. It's, as the wonderful English expression has, like nailing jelly to the wall.
Yeah.
It's just impossible to do it. At the same time, I found this wonderful anthropological study of Muncie, Indiana, in the 70s, where they described what they called the Christmas tree rule. Now, anyone who isn't an anthropologist says, well, that's absurd. Christmas trees don't have rules. What anthropologists do, of course, is they observe and they draw generalizations from what individuals do. And the minute you run through what they list as the Christmas tree rules, you think, well, yeah, we do that. Yeah, we do that. Yeah, of course, we do that. And the Christmas tree rules are things like if you are married with children, you almost certainly have a tree. If you are single without children, you almost certainly don't have a tree. If you are married with no children yet, or your children have left home, the odds are you don't have a tree. But if your children have left home, they will have a tree and you will go and put the presents under their tree. So all these things that we think don't have rules actually have quite firm rules.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the sort of, I guess, what we think is the religious beginnings here. And it's interesting that birthdays, there wasn't much of a religious significance in the early church to this idea of birthdays. And so how it is that we came around to having Christmas celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ, how does that happen? At first it's January 6th, then it starts to shift. Just give us a sense of how this happens.
Well, January 6th is Epiphany, which is ostensibly the baptism of Christ. So it's not the birth, but the birth into the church.
Yeah.
So that actually makes perfect sense as a religious ceremony and for a church to mark the day. The origins of Christmas, as everybody knows, I mean, if you speak to most people, they'll say something vague about, oh, yeah, Roman Saturnalia, right?
Yeah.
And up to a point, yes, right. The origins of Christmas emerge out of a lot of overlapping traditions. There was indeed the Roman Saturnalia, which is just before Christmas.
Solstice, right?
No. It was before the solstice. There is the calends, the new year, which is exactly when you would expect it to be. It ran from the 1st to the 3rd of January, although tellingly, it gradually spread to the 5th and even the 6th of January, i.e. almost to Epiphany.
Yeah.
What you had on the 25th, which was the solstice, was the by the end of the Roman Empire, the main religion of the Roman Empire was Mithraism. And the god Mithras is born on the 25th of December, on the solstice. And so it sort of all merges. Mithras, apart from anything else, is also known as the unconquerable sun, S-O-N, not S-U-N.
Yeah.
And so gradually you get this linkage to the birth of Mithras, who is born in a cave, which one of the proto-gospels also has Christ born in a cave.
Right. So people were used to basically commemorating a sacred figure's birth on the 25th, so they adapt the Jesus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing which you've got, which is very important, is that in agricultural times, pre-industrial times, December, January are in the Northern Hemisphere, the quiet times of the year. There's not a lot of work to be done. At the end of November, early December, depending on where you live, you have slaughtered the animals that you can't afford to overwinter and preserved the meat. So you've got a lot of meat, which is festival food. Again, depending on which part of the Northern Hemisphere you come from, you've either made your wine or you've brewed your beer. So you've got drink, and you haven't got a lot to do.
Right.
So it is the perfect time for whatever it is, Saturnalia, New Year's celebrations, Mithraic rites, whatever those are, it is sensible that they all take place at this time of year.
Christmas celebrations of the past. Well, there was lots of mischief and pranks and dressing up as animals and priests. Maybe say something about what mumming was.
Mumming was a tradition in England where people dressed up. They went house to house. They played either instruments or they banged on, you know, sort of hollow barrels and things to make big noises. They sang. They would go to each house. They would expect to be given food and drink. In some traditions, they might be disguised, and finding out who they were was part of it. In other traditions, they would play pranks. In Northern Europe, in some of the German areas, in some of the Scandinavian areas, it was very much a thing of they would shoot off guns. Not at people, you understand, in
right.
the air.
which
translated in, and you see it in the States, in many parts which had heavy German immigration or Scandinavian immigration. Today they have fireworks, which is the transformation of shooting. They would sing, they would be offered in exchange drink, small bits of food. It was an entertainment,
yeah.
But there was other more organized entertainment. The guilds, the crafts guilds in various cities would put on pageants, sort of plays that were performed on carts as they moved through the streets. We don't know a lot about them, but we know that they were Christmas-themed
yeah.
plays.
But wait, was there any... Was there ever a nativity? Was there ever a baby Jesus that came into play in all of this? I mean, how much religious sentiment was even expressed in those entertainments?
The guild plays had religious bases. The mumming had none. Hmm. The mumming was a people's thing, and it was pure entertainment.
Yeah.
It was pure, let's sing, let's dance, let's drink as much as we can, and make as much noise as we can.
Yeah.
The more organized elements had some religious basis. There were also things that today to us seem a little eccentric because we're so focused on this single day. But in Germany, for instance, you had a genre in the Middle Ages called the Paradise Play.
Yeah.
And that occurred in the streets on the 24th of December because that is the feast day of Adam and Eve. It had nothing to do with Christmas. They simply told the story of the expulsion from the Garden of Eden.
Wow.
But it's interesting to us today because in their need to have a tree of knowledge in December in northern Germany, they would not use an apple tree or any other kind of tree that would lose its leaves. They would use a fir tree. And to make it look like the tree of knowledge, they would tie apples on to the branches. So this was very much a precursor of the Christmas tree. The plays, the paradise plays, fell out of fashion. But people liked the trees and kept them.
Wow. So the Christmas tree is connected to the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden.
A bit. People very swiftly forgot what
right.
they were had anything to do with
of course.
That, and they just wanted some decorated
yeah.
trees in
yeah.
December. It was dark and gloomy.
Well, I like that because you write about how a lot of money was spent on greenery in those days. I mean, holly and pine boughs, and this association between trees and Christmas really starts to take hold, I guess.
Well, there's A very interesting thing, because the English were very focused on greenery. As you say, there was holly, there was ivy, there was whatever was green at that time of year, bay, rosemary, things that we don't think of as Christmassy at all anymore. In the German-speaking lands, they were more focused on a tree. And we know in the 15th century, there was a tree in Freiburg in the 1540s. A little later, we know of a decorated tree in Reval, in what is now Tallinn in Estonia. Both of those were outdoor trees.
Yeah.
They were put up in public, they were decorated, and people enjoyed them. The first indoor tree we know of is 1605, and that's in Strasbourg, which became the heart of Christmas tree country.
Martin Luther cuts down a Christmas tree for his family.
Martin Luther probably didn't cut down a Christmas tree.
Oh, is that right?
I'm really, really, really sorry to tell you, but probably not. Martin Luther lived in Wittenberg. That's a couple of hundred kilometers from Christmas tree country around Strasbourg. And the first decorated Christmas tree we know of in his region is in the 18th century.
So it's a legend that Luther did.
It's a legend, yeah, I'm okay. afraid. Pretty well everything we know about Christmas is wrong.
Isn't it the truth? That's Judith Flanders. She's an historian of the Victorian era. Her new book is called Christmas, A Biography. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Judith Flanders is with us to talk about her biography of Christmas. She's joining us to explain how nearly everything we know about Christmas is probably wrong. I want to talk about personification. This was fascinating because this kind of gets us to the Santa figure later on. But you mentioned this English clergyman, Richard Smart, who may have written the first carol to greet Christmas, not as a religious festival, you say, or even as a season, but as a person. And this idea of the personification of the holiday is interesting, and it sounds like it got pretty out there, pretty wild.
Well, English carols are fascinating because they're, if you read the definition in the dictionary, what is a carol? You could be entirely forgiven for assuming that 95% of what the English sing as carols don't qualify because they tell us their songs in praise of the Nativity. And most English carols are about winter, they're about drinking, they're about feasting, and they're about having a good time.
Yeah.
And this early carol that you mention is very much in that tradition. The chorus line of that song is in Norman French, which was then by then very old-fashioned, but still was slightly in use in England. Buvez bien pour toute la compagnie. Everyone should drink well, lots. Make good cheer. Yeah. Be merry. And that is what Sir Christmas, as he was called in this carol, became. He was in charge of eating and drinking and feasting.
It's so interesting that you have these other personifications that emerge, goats and ragged hermits or devils, wild men. Say something about that. In the Netherlands, there was a Black Peter. What was their relationship to the holiday?
Well, you have various saints who appear in late November, early December, who give out fruit and nuts. There's St. Martin, St. Martin's Eve, which is in November. He gives out apples and nuts to good children in the Low Countries. There's St. Nicholas, who on December the 6th also gives fruit and nuts to good children. He's the patron saint of children. But as well as that, there are various characters who punish the bad children, because right. the saint doesn't do that. Yeah. And they are, for the most part, sort of outsider figures of some sort or another. They might wear sort of rough animal skins. They carry a whip or a crop to beat bad children with. Sometimes they're devils themselves. Sometimes they're hermits who live in the woods. There's the odd woman, not very many women. They're mostly bad men. And they're often associated with dirt, or they're in some way inferior. They're called servants, or the German ones often have the prefix Ru, which means rough. Rather enchantingly for us, there was one known as RuPaul. Yeah, that made me laugh out loud in the library. I was frowned at. And it's spelled the same way, R-U.
Wow.
There was Peltznickel, pelts meaning fur, an animal skin. There was Père Fouettard in France. He was Father Whip. He carried a whip and beat bad children. Mm-hmm. And so there were all of these sort of outsider characters. Most of them have vanished, and we don't know much about them today. One of the few that has survived is Farta Pete, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing wrong, Black Peter in Dutch, who accompanies St. Nicholas. And today there is a lot of trouble with this idea because Zwarte Piet is black. And so what's happened in the Netherlands over the last century or so is people put on blackface, which, as you can imagine, is not hugely popular.
Yeah.
So those are two traditions which are sort of clashing at the moment.
Mm. Let's talk about what's going on in America in the early days. People were leaving their homes in Europe, of course, during this time to settle elsewhere, taking their brand of these holiday traditions with them, which gets us to North America and the settlers who came here. Mm-hmm. What were the holiday celebrations like for example, the Puritans? They had one brand, but then there were others too, of course.
Well, those are two questions. The holiday traditions that went, I mean, one of them that I just mentioned, Peltznickel, went with many of the German immigrants from the Rhine area of Germany to what was mostly then Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And in Pennsylvania Dutch, which of course is not Dutch, but German, Pennsylvania Deutsch, he became Peltznickel, transformed himself into the Bellsnickel. And the German immigrants and their descendants kept up the mumming parading tradition of their homeland, and they went Bellsnickeling, which I think is, apart from anything else, is a wonderful word.
Yeah.
So they took these traditions in part of the Appalachians. The shooting traditions of Germans carried through. They would fire off guns on Christmas Eve.
So the other part is the Puritans, right? You have all this ribald, celebration, and then the Puritans, what, they're wagging their fingers at people who are trying to celebrate? Is that how it works?
Well, of course, that's the really interesting part, because I always get a mild laugh out of people who talk about the war on Christmas,
yeah,
because the people who talk about the war on Christmas are almost without fail, shall we say, it, not Puritans, because nobody is a Puritan anymore, but they are puritanical. And the only official war on Christmas that has ever existed was a war that was perpetrated by the church. The Puritans in North America and the church in England in the 17th century were vehement about a return to the scriptures as the only sanctioned truth
yeah.
of religion. Now, of course, there is no mention of Christmas in the Bible. Therefore, the Puritans believed that Christmas is a Roman Catholic invention and to be shunned and scorned and indeed banned. So in New England, in the 17th century, the Puritans banned Christmas and it was officially not allowed to be observed. The same happened in England between the 1640s and 1660. There was a slight hitch, which always makes me laugh, because the Scottish Church managed sneakily to get Christmas rebanned in 1690. And then, you know how these things happen, people forgot about it, and Christmas remained banned in Scotland until 1958.
Wow.
I mean, no one paid any attention.
Of course.
But officially, Christmas was illegal in Scotland for a quarter of a millennium.
That's amazing. Let's talk about the holiday and booze. Because as you put it in the book, alcohol was simply always a part, I guess, of Christmas.
Alcohol was absolutely a part of Christmas. One of the things that I found when I was searching various databases, I found a court case in the 19th century in London where a woman had been murdered and her husband was asked to testify where he had been the night his wife was murdered. And he said that, unfortunately, he couldn't say where he was the night his wife was murdered because, being Christmas, he said, he was so drunk he had no recollection of the day at all.
And that would be understandable, I guess, at that time, right?
And, well, shortly afterwards, if you read through the lesser court reports, a man who was up on a drunken disorderly charge said to the magistrate he hoped the magistrate would be lenient because it was the Christmas season.
Right.
And the magistrate said, we can assume in a very weary tone of voice, that if he had accepted that excuse, he would have had to let everyone in the past 3 weeks go.
Right.
Verdict, guilty as charged. But we have this going back on Captain Cook's expedition. The naturalist Joseph Banks wrote in his diary that the crew kept Christmas in what he called the old-fashioned way. All hands, he wrote, were as drunk as our forefathers used to be on like occasion.
Let's talk about, I want to ask you the idea of giving toys, and there's a long history of this. The idea, it was just an extension of something that you write about, this hierarchical gift-giving practice. A social superior gives an inferior, though it did work the other way around at times. And then the same comes to apply to parents and children, I guess. So first it was gifts to the lowly, to the servants. Then,
no, was actually the other way around.
Right. Okay. Yes,
it puzzles us today, yeah. And it's hard to for us to work our heads around it. But actually, originally, it was inferiors who gave gifts to their superiors.
Yeah.
So you're talking about a society built on patronage. And therefore, the lower partner in the partnership reminds his patron that he's there and he's a wonderful human being, and therefore the patronage should continue through the year, please. So you have, for example, tenants giving their landlords, nothing elaborate, you know, some wildfowl, perhaps. You have the, on a higher level, you have the nobility giving the ruler gifts, and those were very elaborate. Gradually, this fades out, and you have, as you described, a society where the greater give the lesser. They begin to give what are, in effect, Christmas tips.
Yeah.
Now, it's not merely that you would give them the way we do today to the 17th century equivalent of your hairdresser and you know, the garbage man.
Yeah.
But it was also, again, a patronage thing. Samuel Pepys, the diarist, records that his patron, the Earl of Sandwich, who was the head of the Navy, gave him sack wine, which he got to go to the Earl's cellar and choose himself.
Wow.
In the meantime, Pepys went to the shopkeepers that his wife bought from and gave them money.
Judith Flanders, her book is Christmas, a Biography. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Judith Flanders. We're talking about her book, Christmas, a Biography. Let's talk about Santa Claus. I guess that it takes a while for the Santa Claus image, of course, to get settled. It evolves the color of his clothes, the idea of who he is and what he is. There's the Clement Clark Moore's poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, that, and then, of course, Washington Irving. I guess in some ways, does he basically invent Santa Claus, create Santa Claus in some way?
I think Washington Irving, we can hold Washington Irving responsible for an awful lot of this.
Yeah.
We can't say absolutely that Washington Irving invented Santa Claus. It's kind of more of a emanation from a bunch of sources. Washington Irving wrote, amongst other things, the Knickerbocker History of New York, which at the time was recognized as political satire. And what he was doing is he was holding up modern-day New York. This is the very early part of the 19th century. He's holding up modern-day New York to satire by comparing it to what he said were the good old days of New Amsterdam. In fact, most of what he said about New Amsterdam was made up because it was satire. It wasn't history. Within a few decades, people had forgotten that it wasn't history and treated it as though it were actually factual. So a lot of the confusion about St. Nicholas comes from Washington Irving and from this misunderstood book. For example, he says that St. Nicholas was the patron saint of New Amsterdam and the first church in New York was named for him. In actual fact, there was no St. Nicholas Church in New York until the 20th century. And St. Nicholas wasn't the patron saint of New Amsterdam because New Amsterdam was under the authority of the Dutch Reformed Church, which was vehemently anti-saint.
Right.
So it's made up.
Yeah.
We do have, though, this very, very curious anomaly, which is that in 1773 and 1774, which is a decade before Washington Irving is born,
yeah,
in a New York newspaper, there is a notice which mentions that the anniversary of St. Nicholas, otherwise called Santa Claus, was celebrated at such and such a place.
Gosh.
And to tell you the honest truth, we simply don't know what that means or where it comes from. It's totally out of sync with every other mention of Santa Claus, which doesn't arrive till the 1810s, 1820s, and Washington Irving. I have a theory, but it's a theory.
Let's hear it.
And my theory is that you had a very large exodus, a lot of immigrants from German Switzerland in the 18th century. Most of them went to North Carolina and Pennsylvania, but some did go to New York. And in Schwitzerdeutsch, in Swiss German, there were two dialect names for St. Nicholas. One was Santi Claus and one was Sammy Claus. Now, both, to me, sound much more like Santa Claus than Washington Irving's rather contrived St. Nicholas. version of supposed Dutch. So I wonder if that was a group of Swiss immigrants who were enjoying the holiday.
By the late 1800s, you say Santa had become, you know, substantially different from all other Christmas gift bringers. And I guess what's interesting about this to me is that Santa Claus, as you say in the book, had no religious associations. And in fact, I hadn't thought about this, Santa is the reverse of Jesus Christ. Fat and old, wears red, lives in the North Pole, is married, owns a factory. I mean, right? I mean, everything contrary to the idea of the Christian idea of Jesus.
Well, you know, he is absolutely the opposite. He's old. He's not newborn. He's, as you say, as I said, he owns a factory. He produces luxury goods. Turning water into wine is as close as you can get. He's the god of hedonistic enjoyment. He's the exact opposite of the man who said it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. Mm. One of the very earliest cartoonists who drew what has become our image of Santa Claus, Nast, who drew Santas from the 1860s to the 1880s. He took the fur coats of John Jacob Astor, that wonderful slum landlord, and put them onto Santa Claus. He used the face of Bacchus, the Greek god of wine, as the face of Santa Claus. This was not about a child in the Middle East.
I want to ask about Dickens, A Christmas Carol, or Dickens in general. What is going on? You write that Dickens showed the world that Christmas and modernity are eminently suited to each other. So I want to have you explain this, because you say now we're dealing with, in Dickens' time, a world of offices and working late and trying to get home in time for Christmas dinner. And Christmas Carol is a new way of thinking about Christmas?
Well, as I said, nostalgia has always been a huge element of Christmas. Yeah. So Washington Irving looked back to this fake New Amsterdam. The other story he told, he set in a mythical place called Bracebridge Hall in Yorkshire, where there was a local squire who looked after all the happy dancing peasants as they performed the traditional happy dancing Christmas dances, and played games and went to church and did all of those things. It was entirely made up. What Dickens did only a few decades later was he said, we don't have to make up happy dancing peasants. We can have the sentiment and the emotion attached to Christmas set in the world we all know and we recognize, set in a world of offices where Cratchit is the poor clerk who doesn't earn enough to buy a decent Christmas meal and who worries about the unpaid day of holiday. We can worry about his daughter who only just scrapes home in time for Christmas dinner. It was the world people saw around them. And yet, at the same time, Dickens showed you could put all of the emotion and all of the warmth and all of the emotional attachment that previously people had felt they needed to impose on centuries past, you could put it on the modern world.
It's interesting. You write about how in 1936, there was a Christmas window display at Lord & Taylor in New York. It's a department store. Was. And they had recorded
still
music.
Still is.
Still is. Okay, still is. Yeah. They had recorded music, and religious music was rejected. What does that reveal? Because I guess it does raise the question of whether or not there was a moment when the commerce part does completely move the even partial religious part out of the way of Christmas.
I'm not sure that was the point then. The story went that when they were planning their recorded music at Lord and Taylor's, they said, what about putting in a few carols? And the snappish answer was, this is Lord and Taylor's, not St. Patrick's.
Right.
But it goes back to that point of what is a Christmas carol? And Deck the Halls with Boughs of Holly is not about religion. God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, not about religion. So I think that there is, has always been this ambivalence between what exactly holiday music is. And no one is quite certain. Yes, of course, there are carols that are purely religious. They tend, I must stress, to mostly be usually German. The English carols were almost entirely secular. And so precisely in that 30s, 40s moment, you have the birth of popular music songs linking to Christmas, particularly as the decade goes on, you fall into the war period. You get Christmas and patriotism. You get Christmas and nostalgia again, this time for your families at home. So you get White Christmas. You get Chestnuts Roasting by an Open Fire. You get all of those songs which are about family and emotion, but not about religion. And I may add, most of those songs are written by non-Christians.
Right.
You know, the most famous one,
Irving Berlin
is...
You say in the book that in many ways, religion was grafted onto consumerism rather than consumerism grafted onto religion.
It does seem to me that that is what happened, that the day, yes, is chosen by the church. But after that, it's very much a holiday of seasonal enjoyment. And the church kind of just seems to keep bobbing up and going, hey, guys, don't forget us. We're still here.
Right.
And we go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And we go on eating and drinking and putting up trees and things. And what the church does is they co-opt these elements. So, for example, the Sunday school movement in the early 20th century co-opted the Christmas tree, which had had no religious elements at all, and started to have them in Sunday schools, or would have one at a church bazaar, or would, might even have one in a church. But these were elements that the church took from the secular world, not the other way around. In England, we have a very famous carol service, the service of Nine Lessons and Carols, in which carols are interspersed with a church service. The BBC has broadcast it every year since the late 1920s. And they will tell you, indeed they have told you in their publicity material, that this carol service has been going on since King's College, where it is sung, since the chapel was built 500 years ago. Well, actually, really sorry to tell you, but the carol service was invented in the 1880s. Carols had been an entirely secular element of life. They were a working class, secular thing. And what the church did was it took these songs off the street and off the people and put them into a church service.
Let me ask you this finally, because you come around in the book to insights about Christmas given by Ebenezer Scrooge's nephew Fred.
It's my favorite passage.
Yeah. Would you say something about this? Because I think this is where you've settled about how we should all be thinking about Christmas.
I think the thing about Christmas is not, is there a war on Christmas? Was it better? Did we do it differently? Did we do it the same? The rituals of Christmas allow us to believe, even if only for one day a year, that a better world exists, and that somehow by repeating the rituals, we can go back to this better world every time. It's not nostalgia for the Christmases of our childhood, or the Christmases that we've read about, or James Stewart in A Wonderful Life. It's all of these things together, and they create a new reality. Because ultimately, we need to believe that Christmas is, as Scrooge's nephew Fred tells him, a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time of, in the long calendar of the year, when men and women seem, by one consent, to open their shut-up hearts freely, and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe that it has done me good, and will do me good, and I say, God bless it. Gets me every time.
That's Judith Flanders. Her new book is called Christmas, A Biography. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Michael Havey. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.